Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om. Reading from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, chapter entitled Contents of the Gita Summarized, verses 52 and 53. Yatate moho kalilam. Buddhir vyayati tarisyati tadagantasi nirvedam shatavyasya shutasya cha. When your intelligence has passed out of the dense forest of delusion, you shall become indifferent to all that has been heard and all that is to be heard. Purport. There are many good examples in the lives of the great devotees of the Lord, of those who became indifferent to the rituals of the Vedas, simply by devotional service to the Lord. When a person factually understands Krishna and his relationship with Krishna, he naturally becomes indifferent to the rituals of fruitive activities. Even though an experienced Brahmana, Srimadavendra Puri, a great devotee and acharya in the line of devotees, says, O my prayers, three times a day, all glories to you. O bathing, I offer my obeisances unto you. O demigods, O forefathers, please excuse me for my inability to offer you my respects. Now, wherever I sit, I can remember the great descendant of the Yadu dynasty, Krishna, the enemy of Kamsa, and thereby I can free myself from all sinful bondage. I think this is sufficient for me. The Vedic rites and rituals are imperative for neophytes. Comprehending all kinds of prayers three times a day, taking a bath early in the morning, offering respects to the forefathers, etc. But when one is fully engaged in Krishna consciousness and is engaged in his transcendental loving service, one becomes indifferent to all these regulative principles because he has already attained perfection. If one can reach the platform of understanding by service to the Supreme Lord Krishna, he has no longer to execute different types of penances and sacrifices as recommended in revealed scriptures. And similarly, if one has not understood that the purpose of the Vedas is to reach Krishna and simply engages in rituals, etc., then he is uselessly wasting time in such engagements. Persons in Krishna consciousness transcend the limit of Shabda Brahma or the range of the Vedas and Upanishads. Text 53. Shruti viprati panate yadas tasyati nishchala samadav achala buddhis tada yogam avapsyasi. When your mind is no longer disturbed by the flowery language of the Vedas and when it remains fixed in the trance of self-realization, then you will have attained the divine consciousness. Purport. To say that one is in samadhi is to say that one has fully realized Krishna consciousness. That is, one in full samadhi has realized Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. The highest perfection of self-realization is to understand that one is eternally the servitor of Krishna, and that one's only business is to discharge one's duties in Krishna consciousness. A Krishna conscious person or unflinching devotee of the Lord should not be disturbed by the flowery language of the Vedas, nor be engaged in fruitive activities for promotion to the heavenly kingdom. In Krishna consciousness, one comes directly into communion with Krishna, and thus all directions from Krishna may be understood in that transcendental state. One is sure to achieve results by such activities and attain conclusive knowledge. One has only to carry out the orders of Krishna or his representative, the spiritual master. Srila Prabhupada ki jaya. Okay, Hare Krishna. So we see here in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is speaking about the Vedas and how the Vedas contain various types of knowledge. So what I wanted to do in the course of today's class is to speak about the Vedic teachings, look at the Vedic teachings and compare them with modern teachings or modern culture. Also look at some of the dangers when approaching the Vedas. Because here in the verses, Krishna is warning Arjuna to be careful when he approaches the Vedas. And finally, to conclude, exploring the essence of the Vedic teachings. So Prabhupada, in a class in 1976, he was given a class in Paris. And in that class, he described that the Vedas are like a manual. Just like if you buy some goods, you get a manual with it, right? If you buy a vacuum, a computer, a laptop, a TV, it comes with a manual. And so the idea is that the manual helps you use the appliance. If you don't have the manual, then perhaps you can only use it to a certain degree. So similarly, Prabhupada is comparing the Vedas to a manual for our lives, how we can live it. And in that class, he quotes the verse, Vedesh cha sarve aham eva vedyo, Vedantikrit vedavit eva chaham. Vedantikrit, Krishna explains that he is the compiler of the Vedas. So through the Vedic teachings, Krishna teaches us how we can live our lives in the best way, the most productive way. And it's quite interesting because in terms of knowledge, so many people have so many ideas of how we should live our lives. But Krishna is described as apurusha. He is not conditioned by any defect. He has no limitation. It's described in the Shastras that we have defects. And in particular, the Shastras state 4. Brahma pramada ripalipsa karuna paitava. So Brahma means... I'll explain what they all mean. The first one is we have imperfect senses. Right? Everyone agrees we have imperfect senses. Anyone have perfect senses here? Right? I doubt it. Right? We all have imperfect senses. And because we have imperfect senses, it's said that we have the tendency to become illusioned. And because we have the tendency to be illusioned, we make mistakes. And it's described, because we make mistakes, we cheat. Because, you know, no one wants to be known as someone who makes mistakes. So to cover that up, we have to cheat. So Krishna is perfect. And so the knowledge he gives is perfect. And the Vedas, they promote a certain lifestyle, a certain culture, a certain way we should live our life. But we see, even in India, which is considered the home of Vedic culture, people in general are very hesitant to take up the principles presented in the Vedic teachings. Many consider that the Vedic teachings are perhaps irrelevant, right? They're for old people, right? Often you get this accusation that our temple life, spiritual life, is for when you retire, right? When you've got nothing better to do, that's the time to practice spiritual life. In fact, in our Brahmacharya Ashram, I'm from the manor, I think someone just mentioned that at the beginning, in London, the famous temple that George Harrison from the Beatles donated. And he finished his studies and he joined the temple. And his parents were very concerned that he sacrificed his potential to have a great career and join the temple. So they came to the temple and explained their concerns to the management. And they were arguing that, you know, we don't mind him practicing spiritual life, but it's something that he should do perhaps later in life. You know, when he's my age, his father said. So he was saying like this. So the temple devotee, he said, okay, fine, you can take your son back, no problem. And he said, by the way, sir, how old are you? And he said he was 50, 55. So he said, that's pretty old, right? And he said, yeah, that's pretty old. Spiritual life is for old people, right? And so he said, okay, the son can go back, but you join instead. And so hearing this, he was a little shocked. And then he changed his tune. He said, okay, no problem. Maybe he can stay for 1 or 2 years. And then he'll come back. So like this, we see people have hesitations over practicing Vedic culture. Also, a lot of people feel that if I practice spiritual life, what will I get out of it, right? Often people are more inclined to practice the culture that we see in the modern world. You know, and if you analyze it carefully, why we follow a particular lifestyle is because we think we're going to get something from it, right? If you analyze modern culture, what's it about? You know, it's about gaining money, perhaps, attaining power, looking good, And people feel that if I have these things in my life, then I'll be happy. But if you look at the material world carefully, if you scrutinize and analyze it, you'll see for most people that practice this modern culture, it isn't the case. Modern culture means to try and satisfy the mind and the senses, right? If it feels good, do it. If it looks good, go for it. That is the motivation. In the UK, actually, there was an interesting campaign recently by the Humanist Society. Basically, the Humanist Society is an atheistic society. And they were trying to promote atheism. And so someone very wealthy in the Humanist Society had donated a huge sum of money. And in practically all the buses, particularly in central London, there was a huge banner plastered on the buses. And the caption was, "There is probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy life." There's a huge caption on all the buses in London. I remember one particular day, I was in central London, and all day long I saw these buses with these captions, and I was getting very, very frustrated being a Hare Krishna. On my way back, because I was going from central London to the manor, I noticed a caption also within the train. But it was quite interesting, because right next to the caption, there was another advertisement. And on the advertisement, it had two sections. One was called myths, and one was called facts. So on the myths section, there were various statements. So the first statement was that no one suffers from mental illness. And on the fact section, it said, one in four, this is in the UK, one in four suffer from mental illness. Now, this is quite interesting because that's only who's registered as suffering from some mental illness. Most times, if someone's depressed or stressed, they generally don't report it. So in the UK, it's a fact that one in four people suffer from some mental difficulty. And in the next statement, it said, myth. No one knows anyone that suffers from mental illness. And on the facts section, it said, everyone knows at least one person that suffers from a mental illness. So this is the result of modern culture. Enjoy life. Don't worry, there's no God. But what's the result? Do you actually enjoy life? The facts show somewhat different. And someone may think, okay, those that are suffering from mental difficulties are probably, you know, unemployed people or bums or people that just didn't make it in society. But it's quite interesting. Just a month ago, a good friend of mine who's a student at Oxford University, everyone's heard of Oxford University here, obviously. It's one of the, it's considered one of the most prestigious educational institutions in the world. Perhaps many from India also would dream of studying at Oxford University. But he was telling me, bi-weekly, there's a publication produced, which is like a student newsletter. And in a recent newsletter, it said that 40% of students at Oxford University have to undertake regular counseling. Now, this isn't some, you know, run-down university that no one's ever heard of. This is Oxford University. But 40% of the students at that particular university have to regularly see a counselor because they have difficulties dealing with their mind. So this is the modern culture. Yeah. Just recently, a devotee called Bhadrayan Prabhu, who's a disciple of Srila Prabhupada, he was in the UK and he was giving a class. And he was explaining how before he joined the Hare Krishnas, became a devotee, he used to be an operator for a suicide crisis line. Interesting occupation, obviously. And he was explaining in San Francisco that there's a famous bridge. And that bridge isn't famous for connecting two parts of San Francisco. It's famous because many people commit suicide off it. And the local authorities were seeing this, that so many people are attempting suicide. So they decided to build a huge fence around the bridge to prevent people from, you know, committing suicide. But despite this, people continued to find a gap or some way or another to get around the fence and commit suicide. So eventually they decided to put the number of the suicide crisis line on the bridge. And Bhadrayan Prabhu was explaining, but the problem was they never funded the service. So imagine you're about to commit suicide and you're thinking, you see this number and you think, okay, let me try this phone number. Maybe this can give me some hope or light in my life. And you phone it and you're put on hold. So anyway, one person he was saying that got through to him. And see, the operators on the suicide crisis line are trained in a particular way. They're basically given a list before them. And what they're supposed to do is try and provide an alternative or some hope in that individual's life. So one particular individual, he phoned in. And he was saying he felt like committing suicide. So then Brother Aaron was going through the list. So the first thing he saw was family. So he said to him, I know things are not going so well. You know, things are bad. You want to commit suicide. But what about your family? You got your family to look forward to. He said, no, my wife is divorcing me. So then he looked at the second item. So the second item was work. So he said, okay, you're going for a divorce. Things are bad. But what about your career? You got your career to look forward to. He said, last week I got sacked. I got fired. So then he looked at the third thing. And what was the third thing? Let me remember. Oh, the third thing was your health. He said, okay, your family situation is not good. Your work situation is not good. But what about your health? You have your health to look forward to. He said, a few days ago, I'd been diagnosed with terminal cancer. So he went through the entire list. And every item that he requested the person to respond to, he said, he gave a negative response. So he was thinking in his mind, where are you? You know, I'll give you a push, because he was thinking that in his mind. But this is the material world, that it doesn't matter what path you try, it's like a dead end. He was also explaining, you know, often people think that if my situation isn't good, let me try and adjust my situation, right? If it's not working out in India, let me go to the US, you know, I can make more money there. Or if you've got a partner, a girlfriend, okay, it's not working out, let me try another girl. Or, you know, whatever, you just keep adjusting. That's what it means in the material world. And he was explaining how he was at New York Airport, and he had to go to the Caribbean, he had some service there. And so at the airport, there was a huge advertisement, huge banner, and it said that, are you fed up with the hustle and bustle of New York City, stressed, fed up with the pollution? Go to the Caribbean, come to the Caribbean. It like had a picture of like a tropical island. So anyway, he got into his flight to the Caribbean. He wasn't going because of that. He's a devotee. Anyway, he went to the Caribbean, and he got off there. And there was another advertisement. And it said, are you bored, fed up with the village life in the Caribbean? Go to the city, bright lights, you know, technology. And he had an advertisement of New York. So this is the point. People in New York want to go to the Caribbean, and people in the Caribbean want to go to New York. So we understand from these observations in material nature that it's not going to satisfy us. It's all concoctions. The Vedic culture is by far superior. Like when you read the Mahabharata, the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Ramayana, do you hear about people being depressed? Do you hear about a need for psychiatrists or psychologists? Do you hear about, you know, a recession or an economic crisis? Do you hear about, you know, greenhouse gases? And you don't hear about these things. Vedic culture was by far a superior culture. And the Vedic teachings explain how we can live this ideal lifestyle. But we see that there are certain dangers when we approach the Vedic teachings. Here in this verse, Krishna explains. He says to Arjuna, do not be disturbed by the flowery language of the Vedas. Now it's interesting. In just the last few verses, this topic has been brought up again and again. Just a few verses back, it said, Traigunya visaya veda nistraiguna bhavarjuna. Krishna explains to Arjuna that most of the Vedas are based around the three modes of material nature. Most of the Vedas speak about karma, kanda, activities. In fact, you could say probably 90% of the Vedic teachings present this idea. And as a result, Sankar will speak a little later, is that people are already inclined to enjoy it. But now, they can do it in the name of religion. This is, unfortunately, the situation we're facing when we approach the Vedic teachings. Often the Vedic teachings present that if you worship this demigod, then you can you know, attain beauty. If you worship this god, then you can attain, you know, a good progeny. If you worship this god, then you can attain money, power. So this is what the Vedic teachings are pushing on general. And you see that because of that, often most Hindus that go to a temple, they usually come with their shopping list, right? You know, they go before the deities and they say, Lord, I need this, 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 and I need it next week, right? It's interesting. At the manor, Bhaktivedanta Manor, you notice at certain times of the year, there's, a lot more, you could say, pilgrims visiting the temple, especially with the youth. You notice just before the exams, a lot of youth come. And just before the exam results come out, a lot of youth come. And you see them praying intensely. You know, I was looking at them and I was thinking to Gokulananda, if only I could pray as intensely as this individual is praying to you. But this is the mood and the mentality, unfortunately. And you see that, Shishi Radha Gopinath Ki Jai. And you see that this tendency is not just there in Hinduism, but it's also there in other religions, whether it's Christianity, Islam. Often people want God's kingdom without God. If you explore the descriptions that are there for the heavens and the paradise, whatever they describe it as, it's an extension of this world. More money, more power. It's the same thing. And so this is the warning that Krishna is giving to Arjuna in this section of the Bhagavad Gita. So someone may question, okay, the Vedas are meant to teach an individual the purpose of human life. So why are the Vedas presented in this way? In the first canto, the fourth chapter, it's explained. We hear about the great sage Vyas. Vyas is a great sage who appeared at the end of Dwapara Yuga in the 28th cycle. It's actually a post. So different jivas, different souls, living entities can play that role. But this particular Vyas is actually Krishna Dvaipanya Ras. He's actually none different to Krishna. And it's described that he was meditating in Badrikashram, in the Himalayas, on the bank of the river Saraswati. And being a great personality, he could see the past, the present, and the future. And he saw the future, and he saw the situation that the inhabitants of Kali Yuga would have to face. And since seeing this, he became compassionate. And this is actually a quality of a great soul, that seeing the suffering of others, they naturally become compassionate. Bada dukkha dukkhi. Their suffering is the suffering of others. I know, at least for myself, usually my enjoyment is seeing others suffer. This is my unfortunate position. But this is the quality of great souls. They say, to love to preach is one thing, but to love those who you preach to is another thing. So Vyasadeva, seeing the situation of Kali Yuga, he began to contemplate, how can I help these persons? And so as a result, it's described that he recorded, reorganized, and simplified the Vedic teachings. The Vedas were already there, but they were transmitted orally. But people at that time had perfect memory, Shrutidhar. It's described, whatever they heard, they would remember. But as Kali Yuga progresses, as time progresses, people's memories diminish. So he recorded the Vedic teachings. Not only that, he introduced the Puranas, the Itihastas. He also introduced the Vedanta Sutra, which is considered the Anta, means end. So it's considered like the conclusion of the Vedas. He also introduced the Mahabharata, of which the Bhagavad Gita is the essence of. So he did all these things in an attempt to help the conditioned souls of Kali Yuga. But despite this, he's feeling dissatisfied. He says, Tatami Batami Dhyayo. He said, even though I've compiled these Vedic teachings to help others, I'm not feeling happy, I'm not feeling satisfied. So he's thinking, why is this? So he says, Kim va Bhagavat Dharma na prayana nirupita. He says, perhaps this is because I haven't explained Bhagavat Dharma. Perhaps this is because I haven't explained the glories of Bhagavan or Krishna. And at that point, while Vyasadeva is absorbed in this thought, Narada Muni appears on the scene. And Narada Muni, he confirms this thought that Vyasadeva had. And then Narada Muni begins to elaborate on this principle. He said, Na yadvacha stitra padem hare yasho jagat pavitram pragrinta karhichit tadvyayasam titam yushanti manasa na yatra hamsa niramati yushikshayaha. He explains those words, vachas, that do not describe the glories of Lord Krishna, that do not describe the name, the form, the qualities, the pastimes of Lord Krishna, are compared to a place of pilgrimage for crows. It's quite an interesting analogy. So when crows go on pilgrimage, he describes it like that. And crows, what do they like? They like garbage. So he's explaining that mundane literatures have no benefit whatsoever. And so the Vedic teachings, as we see them, the 90% which are karma kanda activities are promoting mundane activities. So this is the danger. But then he goes on and he describes how, but there is another form of literature which is very beneficial in society. He says, Tadvag visargo janatago ripalvo yasmin prati shlokam abhadaviti api namani anantas yashon kitaniya shimanti gayanti grinanti sarvaha. He says, but that literature which does describe the name, the form, the qualities and pastimes of the Lord, that literature is capable of causing a revolution in the impious lives of today's misdirected civilization. So ultimately, Krishna Katha, Krishna literature, is capable of transforming lives. And we see that from our own lives, right? Right? We've gone from, or at least we're trying to go from Hiranyakashipu to Prahlad. You know, in Kali Yuga, it's hard to be a saint. But by associating with these scriptures, by associating with this transcendental knowledge, we can become purified. And in fact, if you study the purport of that particular verse, you see that Prabhupada, if one wants to create a revolution in society, he outlines how to create a revolution. And this is also the principle of book distribution. You know, the idea is when we give people books, we're trying to change them from demoniac to divine. We're trying to assist them in associating with Krishna's words, the words of Srila Prabhupada. So this is the power and potency of transcendental literature. And in fact, we see as a result of this dialogue between Narada Muni and Vyasadeva, the Srimad Bhagavatam was written. The Srimad Bhagavatam is described as the culmination of Vedic scriptures. In the second verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it said, Dharma Projita Kaita Vatra. So this Srimad Bhagavatam, it kicks out all kaitava, all cheating religion. There's no place for cheating religion in Srimad Bhagavatam. We see here Krishna's warning Arjuna, do not be bewildered by the flowery language in the Vedas. But in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is no flowery language. It's the essence. In the purport, Prabhupada explains that generally people would perform dharma because they get some arta. Means that you perform some religious activity because you get some economic, you know, you get some wealth. And from that wealth, arta, you get karma, you get sense gratification. But now in society, we see that there's no need to perform dharma because karma, sense gratification, is readily available. So he makes this interesting point. The Bhagavatam is also described by Srila Prabhupada as Amala Purana, or the spotless Purana. In the following verse, it says, Nigamo kalpo taro galitam phalam. It's described, it compares the Vedas to a tree. And the mature fruit of that tree is the Srimad Bhagavatam. So through this, we have to be careful of scriptures that promote lower levels of worship. See, the idea of why Vyasadeva wrote karma kanda activities is not for us impious or pious people. It's for the demoniac. So the demoniac want to enjoy their senses. But rather than do it independently, the Vedic teachings give them a process that facilitates their material desires, yet at the same time, they make some progression towards perfection. But it's not that you're meant to stay on that platform. Just like, for example, if a child is studying basic maths for 20 years, it's not the right thing to do. It's pointless. The idea is that one is meant to progress to higher levels of mathematics. So similarly, an individual is meant to progress through higher levels of spiritual practice. So this is the first danger that comes in the Vedic teaching. The second danger I wanted to speak about is that often the Vedic literatures are misinterpreted. In the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada gives a very interesting introduction. He says, one American lady asked me, she said, there are many editions of English editions of the Bhagavad Gita. She asked Prabhupada, which edition should I read? And Prabhupada said, he says in the introduction, from all the editions I have seen, all of them miss the true spirit of the Bhagavad Gita. See, the idea is that the Bhagavad Gita is supposed to present, is meant to be presented according to the intentions of the author. So Krishna is the author. He has a certain desire. He has a certain message he wants to put across to people. So if people misconstrue it, change it, then the message gets lost. It's quite interesting because if you notice the title of the Bhagavad Gita, it's not Bhagavad Gita, but it's Bhagavad Gita as it is. It's quite significant why Prabhupada did that. It's not Bhagavad Gita as it was. It's not Bhagavad Gita how you think it should be. It's Bhagavad Gita as it is. Shivram Swami, he was taking some scholars around the manor, and they appreciated Prabhupada's contribution. But they questioned the title of the Bhagavad Gita. They said, we understand that Prabhupada is a saint, but why does he have to call the Bhagavad Gita Bhagavad Gita as it is? Because it seems like he's implying that all other Bhagavad Gitas are not as it is. And Shiv Rama said that it's not that he's implying it. He's declaring it. He's making sure everyone knows. And if you read the Bhagavad Gita again and again and again and again, Prabhupada will criticize people that change the Vedic teachings to suit their needs. And it's quite interesting because, see, the reason people do this is it's like if you want to get a message across to the public, you know, you can write your own book, you can put it in a bookshop, you can try and propagate that book. But for most people, the public, they're not going to really care. But if you put Bhagavad Gita as your title, if you say that Krishna is actually saying this, then naturally hundreds of people will flock. So unfortunately, people are using Krishna and Krishna's knowledge in this way. But the problem is that you lose the potency of Krishna's words, Krishna's message. Prabhupada gives the example. It's just like medicine, right? When you receive medicine from a doctor, as well as giving the medicine, he gives a prescription, right? He says, okay, you take this medicine 3 times a day for 2 weeks, right? Now, if you, for example, decide, I'm not going to take it 3 times a day for 2 weeks. I'm going to take it once a week for 3 months. What happens? The medicine won't have the effect. So similarly, that's when we see that when people read the Bhagavad Gita that's been misinterpreted, the proper effect isn't there. The interesting thing about Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita is that it's made more devotees than any other Bhagavad Gita. That's the proof. That is the proof that Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita is as it is. Prabhupada took hippies. You know, hippies aren't, you know, pious Indians in Bombay. They're, you know, if you study the culture of the hippies, they were far from that. You know, they lived their lives based on hedonism. But they became saints in a very short time because this is actually a genuine message. The other example given is it's like the hen that lays golden eggs, right? The farmer, he sees that the hen lays golden eggs, but he has to also feed the hen. So he likes one half of the hen, but he doesn't like the other half. So what he decides to do, he decides to cut the hen in half. But what happens? He loses both. So this is what unfortunately people do. They take the Bhagavad Gita, present their particular message, but then they lose the power of the actual message. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's an interesting verse that describes the nature of Vedic teachings. It says, Swata Pramanam Veda Pramanam Shiromani. So the Vedas, Swata Pramanam. Pramana means evidence. Swata means that they're self-evident. Means that the Vedas You don't need to go outside the Vedas to prove the Vedas. The Vedas in them themselves are absolute truth. Pramanam Shiramani. They're the topmost of all authorities, of all types of evidence. According to Lord Chaitanya, they're Shiramani. They're the topmost. They're the crest jewel of all types of evidence. But he warns, he says, Lakshana Karila Swata Prama Mata Hani. He explains that if one misinterprets the Vedic literatures, then they lose their self-evident nature. It means that the Vedic teachings are no longer an authority. If they're self-evident, whatever they present, we accept. But if someone misinterprets the Vedic teachings, then they no longer carry that perfection. Because instead of getting Krishna's message, you're getting someone else's message. And we discussed at the beginning how by nature, humans make errors. So then it's clouded by imperfection. In one book called the Dasmula Tattva, which Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes, he describes that if a verse is clear, then it should just be accepted directly. He gives the example. If a verse says, the son of Mother Sachi is the son of Mother Yashoda, then it's clear. There's no need for interpretation. But if, for example, he says, if there's a verse and it says, cowherd on Ganga. Now this is an unclear verse. So he says, one can interpret in that situation. It means cowherd village on Ganga. But unless it's completely unclear, one should just accept the direct meaning. A lot of philosophers, they say that the Bhagavad Gita is an analogy. It's a metaphor, right? Kurukshetra, there's no place Kurukshetra. It's actually, it just represents the field or the body. And the Pandavas are the five senses. Now the question naturally comes, where is that said in the Bhagavad Gita? If you go to Delhi, there's a place Kurukshetra close by. Pandavas are historical figures. So in this way, they concoct the truth. Srila Prabhupada, one life member came to see Prabhupada, and he was upset because one of Prabhupada's disciples had criticized the Bengali Mayavadi. And he'd called him rascal. And this life member was bewildered. He was upset. And so he began to, share his thoughts. And Srila Prabhupada, hearing this, he tried to pacify him. He said, if my disciple has said something that I have never said, then he is a rascal. My disciple is a rascal. And so the life member was pacified. And behind Prabhupada was a bookshelf. And so Prabhupada pulled out a book from the bookshelf, and it was a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita by a doctor. And so Prabhupada told the life member to open up the Bhagavad Gita and told him to start reading. And the famous verse, Man Mano Bhava Mad Bhakto, was there. And so he told him to read the translation. The translation was fine. And then he told him to read the purport. And so in the purport, this doctor says, when Krishna refers to me, he's not talking about himself. He's talking about the unseen, impersonal Brahman, the absolute truth. And as he was reading this, Prabhupada stopped him and raised his hand. And he shouted to him in a raised voice, this is why I call them rascal. He said, this is why I call them rascal. Because the verse is very clear. But they concoct and create their own meaning. Shankaracharya, who's described in many ways as the leader of the Advaita tradition, he says that direct words cannot be used in relation to indescribable phenomena. So he says that because we're speaking about spiritual subject matters, we can't accept it directly. We have to accept it indirectly. But all he's doing here is juggling with words. Because at the same... direct meaning is words, and indirect meaning is words. Madhvacharya, he explains, in response to this, he said, in examining the power of words, where direct meaning is not accepted, interpretation has no place. Because both are words. If you're saying words have no position to describe the Lord in a direct way, why would indirect words explain the Supreme Lord? And he explains that where there exists no knowledge, where there exists no village, How can one argue about its extent or size? Where there is no Father, why discuss about the Son? So this is the argument against the Shankaracharya teachings. Sometimes they say language is inadequate to describe or convey spiritual truths. But our argument and the Acharya's argument against this is that language is a creation of the Lord. If the Lord wants to convey spiritual truths through language, he can do that. If he wants words, language to carry a spiritual message, he can do that. Just like electricity is transmitted through copper wire. So copper wire isn't the important thing in this issue. The electricity is, but it's a medium. So similarly, language is a medium by which we can understand spiritual truths. It's quite interesting because if you analyze the mentality of the Mayavadis, it's a very evil mentality. Just like once Prabhupada was invited to a Gita Mela. And at the beginning of the Gita Mela, there was an exhibition. And in the exhibition, there was a lamp and there was a picture. And so Prabhupada, when he arrived there, because naturally it's classes on the Bhagavad Gita, he asked, where's the picture of Krishna? And he said, the person, the host, in response said, we don't accept Krishna. We only accept Krishna's words. Sorry, the Gita's words. And so Prabhupada said that at the end of the Gita, the Gita says, surrender to Krishna. And the host said, I don't care. And basically Prabhupada said at the end of it that this is a demoniac mentality. Because they don't accept Krishna, but they accept Krishna's words. They don't accept Krishna, but they want to accept the energy of Krishna. Govind Prabhu was giving an interesting example. He was explaining a pastime from the Mahabharata. He explained that Ashwatthama, he went to Dwarka. And he decided to barter with Krishna. He wanted to trade goods with Krishna. And he wanted to barter the Brahmastra for the Sudarshan Chakra. And Krishna, he wasn't into this bartering. He said, if you want the Sudarshan Chakra, just take the Sudarshan Chakra. So he gave the Sudarshan Chakra to Ashwatthama. But because only Krishna can control the Sudarshan Chakra, Ashwatthama couldn't control it. So eventually Ashwatthama returned it to Krishna. And so Krishna asked Ashwatthama, what did you want the Sudarshan Chakra for? And Ashwatthama was very honest. He said, I wanted to use it to cut your throat. So this is the mentality of Mayavadis. They take Krishna's words, they take the Vedic teachings that are promoting Krishna consciousness, and they try and cut Krishna from it. And Mayavadis, it's not always a gross thing. Some Mayavadis, they even chant Hare Krishna. Some Mayavadis, you know, they can quote shlokas from the Srimad Bhagavatam to you. Once Prabhupada was on a morning walk with a famous personality called Dr. Patel. I don't know if you've heard any of the many morning walks with Dr. Patel. But in one dialogue, the conversation became very heated. And Prabhupada was criticizing the Mayavadis. And Dr. Patel was getting very upset. And in fact, at the end of it, Dr. Patel walked off. And so at the end of it, Tamal Krishna Maharaj asked Prabhupada, is Dr. Patel a Mayavadi or a Vaishnava? So then Prabhupada told a story. He said, in a village, there was a man, and he could speak many languages. So whatever language an individual would speak to that man in, he would respond in that particular language. So no one could figure out what was his mother tongue. So one man, he came up behind him, and he hit him on his head. And so the man cursed, he swore. And so from that curse, from that swearing, he understood what his mother tongue was. So similarly, from that scenario, Prabhupada explained that you could understand what the nature of Dr. Patel was. But still, although Shankaracharya is described as the head of Mayavad teachings, we should not misunderstand his position. In the Shastras, it explains that he is actually none different to Lord Shiva. In the Padma Purana, it's described, it says, Mayavadam asak shastram pachanam buddham uchate Mayava vihitam devi Galoa Brahmane Murtine. He's explaining to his consort Parvati Devi that in the age of Kali, I come as Brahmana Murtine. I come as a Brahmana. And in that age, I propagate Mayavad Asak Shastram. Based on the Vedic teachings, I present this Mayavad philosophy. Prachanam Buddham Uchate. And actually, this Mayavad philosophy is really none different to Buddhism. Lord Shiva is Vaishnavanam Yata Shambhu. He's the greatest Vaishnava. So we can understand from the Shastric references that there was a bigger purpose. And that's perhaps another class in of itself. And in fact, towards the end of Shankaracharya's life, he kind of explained the actual teachings of the Vedas. He says, Bhajagovinda, Bhajagovinda, Bhajagovinda Madhupate, Samprapta Sanhite Kale Nahi Nahi Rakshati Dukra Nekarate. He explains that, he says, Madhumate, he says, O fools, he explains to his disciples, his followers. At the time of death, Rakshati Dukrane Karane, he says that your word jugglery, your grammatical speculation will not help you at the time of death. So he says, Bhaja Govinda, Bhaja Govinda, Bhaja Govinda. He said, worship Govinda, worship Govinda, worship Govinda. In fact, Shankaracharya, in one of his books, he's explained the pastimes of Radha and Krishna. And in that book, he explains the supreme position of Krishna. And if you ask Mayavadis about that book, they become a little embarrassed. And in fact, they try and avoid the issue. Just like, if, for example, if in your family you have an uncle who's in prison, you won't publicize it. You won't really talk about it. You know it exists, but it's not something that you want to publicize. So like this, we see that Shankaracharya has a dual role. He has a particular task to perform. There's also another group of philosophers that interpret the Vedic teachings, the Indologists. In academic circles, Indologists are considered an authority on Vedic teachings. But their understanding or their approach in the Vedic teachings is a lot different to the Vedic approach. Like in the Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, if you want to understand the Vedas, it's not just through acquiring knowledge. But he says, Bhakto sime sakacheti rahasham haitadatamam. He says to Arjuna, because you're my devotee, bhakta, and because you're my sakha, because you're my friend, you can understand this transcendental mystery. He says, bhaktya mam abhijanati. By devotional service, one can understand this knowledge. Once one person came up to Prabhupada and said, Prabhupada, I can recite the Bhagavad Gita in 45 minutes. And Prabhupada said, but the real thing is, can you live it for 45 minutes? So our approach and the academic's approach is a lot different. The academic approach is somewhat like a music critic. Like generally, if there's a musical performance, there'll be a music critic hired, and he'll give a review of the musical performance. But that music critic, he may not be a musician himself, but he's considered an authority on music. But the music, the person who's performing the orchestra, he will know things that the music critic doesn't know. So in one sense, who's more qualified? Or Bhaktivedanta Punaswami, for example, once he was with one academic. And so he asked this academic, in Buddhism, who would be considered an authority on Buddhism? Would it be the Tibetan Dalai Lama? Or someone who studied PhD Buddhism? Now, most people would say that the Dalai Lama would be considered an authority on Buddhism. But this person said that in academic circles, someone who's done a PhD in Buddhism would be considered an authority. Why? Because he can apparently sit from an objective perspective. You know, he doesn't become overwhelmed by the teachings. There are even academics that study, you know, Jiva Goswami's teachings, Rupa Goswami's teachings. They'll know that, like, the suts and durbas inside out. They'll know the fine details of Sanskrit. But they'll be discussing it in a pub or a bar. They'll be discussing it while they're, you know, eating a beef burger. Whereas we may not know the fine details of these perhaps esoteric teachings, but we're living them. So we have to be careful. That's why whenever we accept the Vedic teachings, it has to be done through the eyes of the acharyas. Otherwise we can misunderstand it. So by Srila Prabhupada's compassion, we have Bhagavad Gita as it is, as Krishna spoke it 5,000 years ago. So these are some of the obstacles that we have to be careful when we approach the Vedic teaching. And just to conclude, because I have to finish very quickly, the essence of the Vedic teachings is described by Lord Chaitanya. He says there's three principles that are spoken about in the Vedic teachings. Very simple. Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. Sambandha means knowledge of Krishna, knowledge of who I am and how I can connect with Krishna. Second topic, Abhideya. Abhideya means how I act in that relationship, the practice of devotional service. And finally, Prayojana, the result of that practice, love of God, going back to Godhead. And these principles are exemplified, expanded on in the Bhagavad Gita, the Srimad Bhagavatam, and the Chaitanya Charitamrita. The Bhagavad Gita is considered the essence of the Upanishads. In Shankaracharya glorifies the Bhagavad Gita. He says, Sarva Upanishado Gaivo Dogda Gopala Nandana. He explains that of all Upanishads, this is the essence. The Mahabharata, the essence of the Mahabharata is the Bhagavad Gita. The whole reason Mahabharata was spoken was because Vyasadeva wanted to administer the essence of the Vedas, the Bhagavad Gita, through an exciting story. See, no one's attracted to philosophy nowadays in the culture we live in. We all need some drama, some romance, some conspiracy. And when the Mahabharata reached its peak during the battle of Kurukshetra, Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita. When their attention was at its peak, so this was his strategy. The Srimad Bhagavatam is described as the Amala Purana. You know, of all Puranas, it's the topmost Purana. And the Chaitanya Charitamrita is also considered the essence. Looking at it another way, the Bhagavad Gita is the words of Krishna. But more intimate are the activities of Krishna. That's the Srimad Bhagavatam. And more intimate than that is the mind of Krishna. And this is Chaitanya Charitamrita. So we should take on Prabhupada's words, take on Krishna's words, and understand that Vedic teachings have to be presented and understood in a particular light. And then very quickly, we'll attain success. Hare Krishna. We'll stop there, and maybe if devotees have questions, we can take questions after. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Nitai Gopramanande Hari Hari Bol.